In his rage, he curses the Vasus to be born as mortals on Earth. Just like in his previous life, Shantanu is completely enchanted with Ganga's presence and beauty. Shantanu thinks that that's easy enough. This was an audacious demand. He was giving all that up. Pretty gutsy, really. What if you had a superpower? And what if this superpower gave you the ability to pick the time of your death? How do you think that would change your life? I can't decide if it's a curse or a gift. I mean, what if in a moment of weakness, you choose to die prematurely? Or worse, what if you simply cannot pick a time to die? What happens then? It seems to be tricky, and you have to be a special kind of person to handle something as powerful as that. And that brings me to the character of today's story, Bhishma. Bhishma is a descendant of the Kuru lineage, and he's one of the main protagonists of the Mahabharata. I think of Bhishma as this old, immensely wise, strongly built warrior with long flowing gray hair and beard, a little tragic perhaps, and someone who's all about upholding the dharma and doing the right thing. Bhishma is a character beloved by everyone, and he is loved and admired for always wanting to do the right thing. And sure, he does do some questionable things, as we will see as the story progresses and in other episodes. But that is what this epic is about. The good are not all good and the bad are not all bad. Bhishma had this incredible gift where he could choose the time of his death. Being born a prince, he was born into privilege and power. But this gift landed him in a league of his own. Like Spider-Man, he wasn't born with this power. But unlike Spider-Man, no spiders or other arachnids were involved. So how did he come to possess this power? This gift was a reward for a great personal sacrifice he made in order to keep his father happy. And before we get into the details of how he got this gift, let's look into more about Bhishma's life. His background, his birth, his early life. And along the way, we get to see a couple of love stories that don't exactly belong to him. Namaste. So glad you're here. This is Stories of India Retold. And today we're talking about Bhishma. Not just his early life and his birth, but also why he gave up the throne, why he decided to remain childless, and how he got a gift where he could choose the time of his death. Let's start with Bhishma's parents. Long before Bhishma's birth, there lived a king named Mahabhisha. Mahabhisha was a great king and he followed his dharma. He ruled wisely and fairly. He looked after his people. He had heirs and he performed many austerities. And because he followed his dharma, when his time on earth was over, he gained entry into the heavens. One day in the heavens, the gods were gathered for a great ceremony. And in this ceremony, they were preparing to pay homage to Brahma, the creator. This was a great deal and there was a lot of excitement around it. One attendee in particular generated a lot of excitement, and this was none other than the beautiful goddess River Ganga. When Ganga came into the venue, all eyes were on her. She was beautiful. She looked regal as she walked in. She was draped elegantly in a white cloth. As she entered, a powerful gust of wind blew, taking away the cloth from her body, leaving her vulnerable to the eyes of everyone present. Now, everyone present were of noble birth. So they all do the right thing, the expected thing, the decent thing. All respectfully lower their eyes. That is all except Mahabhisha, who was so enchanted with Ganga's beauty, he neglected to look away. This was absolutely the wrong thing to do. The gods, especially Brahma, were furious with Mahabhisha for failing to do the right thing. They decided that he must be punished for his transgressions. Brahma punished Mahabhisha by telling him to go back to earth and live as a mortal. So this is how it works. The goal of a mortal living on earth is to do enough good during their time there so that when it is over, they can gain entry into the heaven. And in that way, they will escape the cycle of rebirth and they will escape having to live a life of difficulties. And Mahabhisha had already done that. But because of his transgressions, he was being sent back to earth where he would have to live a life of a mortal and face the harsh realities. But after he is done, he could go back to heaven. And fortunately for him, he could also choose who he would be born as. After careful consideration, Mahabhisha chose to be reborn as the son of a king named Pratipa, who belonged to the Kuru lineage. As for Ganga, she too was shaken by what had transpired. She was curious about Mahabhisha. Thoughts of Mahabhisha occupied her mind and she was still thinking about him on her way back home. And that is when she met the Astavasus. The Astavasus, or eight Vasus, are of noble birth, being the children of Brahma. They are deities representing the elements: water, earth, fire, sky, sun, wind, stars, and the moon. Ganga is shocked to find them there because they seem to have lost their forms and they seem to have been displaced from the heavens. They look distressed. She's concerned and so she asks them what happened. And the Vasus reveal all to her. Long story short, one day the Vasus decide to have a picnic of sorts. And so, accompanied by their wives, they all descend down to earth and go to a forest. While they were in this forest, they're all having a good time and at some point they start exploring the place. One of the wives found a cow and its calf grazing peacefully and unafraid in the forest. There was something about this cow. It was beautiful and looked extremely healthy. She was curious about it, so she calls her husband over. Her husband is Prabhasa. He is the deity representing the sky. Prabhasa looks at the cow and he immediately recognizes it. He tells his wife that this is a divine cow belonging to the great sage Vasistha. He also reveals to her that the milk of the cow was said to be tasty and extremely powerful. The person who drinks the milk of the cow would live up to 10,000 years, all the while maintaining their youth. Now this piques his wife's interest. She decides that this cow and its calf would make a wonderful gift for a dear friend of hers, a princess by the name Jinavati, who is the daughter of Rajarishi Ushinara. She shares her plans with her husband. Prabhasa thinks about it and he decides that it's a great idea. And that is how the Vasus, led by Prabhasa, end up stealing the cow and its calf. Now, cattle stealing was common enough during those days, but this was no ordinary cow and it belonged to no ordinary person. Sage Vasistha was a powerful and influential sage, and he used the milk from this cow to perform the many important rites and rituals that he performed. And so this cow was very beloved to him. And what's more is that the Vasus were aware of the fact, and they still went and stole from him. That evening, when Vasistha returns back home and finds that both his cow and its calf were missing, he is worried. And when he figures out what exactly happened, he is furious. In his rage, he curses the Vasus to be born as mortals on earth. When the Vasus come to know about the curse, they panic. They rush to Vasistha and beg for his mercy. Now, Vasistha had softened towards them by then. However, there was nothing he could do about the curse. Why? Because you couldn't simply cancel it. You see, for the people during the ancient times, it was very important to not speak untruths. And so, if they said that something would happen a certain way, if that didn't happen that way, then that would mean that they have spoken untruths. And they wouldn't have that. And so you cannot negate a curse. But certain compromises or remediations can be made, as you will soon see here. Vasistha tells the Vasus that they would have to be born as mortals on earth as he had cursed them, but they need stay there only for a short while before returning back to heaven. But Prabhasa, the Vasu who masterminded and led the theft, would have to lead a full life as a mortal on earth before returning to heaven. Vasistha tells them that Prabhasa would be reborn as a skilled warrior. He would make sure his father was always happy. He himself would remain childless in his lifetime. Those were Sage Vasistha's final words on the matter. The Vasus could not imagine a worse punishment. They were devastated, and this is how Ganga found them. The Vasus beg Ganga for help. They tell her that they want her to give birth to them. They say that if they have to be born as mortals and on earth, then they would rather be born to someone of noble birth, like Ganga. Ganga feels sorry for them, so she agrees. The Vasus tell her that the son of King Pratipa would be their father. Now Ganga knows that Mahabhisha would be born as the son of King Pratipa, which would mean that she would have to marry the person Mahabhisha would be reborn as. This makes Ganga happy, so she consents. The Vasus add that they want Ganga to kill them as soon as they are born by throwing them into the water, because they absolutely did not want to spend more time on earth than they had to. Ganga thinks about it, and she tells them that she wants her husband to have at least one heir, and so she would spare one child. Which unlucky Vasu do you think would be spared? It was Prabhasa. The Vasus agree. They were immensely satisfied with their arrangement with Ganga, and as a thank you for what she was doing for them, each Vasu promised 1/8 of their elemental energy to the son who would survive. But they warn Ganga that he himself would remain childless in his lifetime. With that, Ganga and the Vasus reach an agreement. Now for Ganga to keep her promise, she would have to meet Pratipa. And an opportunity arises when Ganga finds King Pratipa meditating on the banks of the river Ganga. Ganga goes to him, she introduces herself, and she offers her hand in marriage. Pratipa is not interested, so he politely declines. But you don't simply refuse a woman as powerful as Ganga. And so Pratipa offers her the hand of his son instead. Now keep in mind, this son isn't born yet. But Ganga accepts. And she has a few conditions of her own. Her conditions are, one, her husband must never know her real identity as a woman of high birth. And two, he must never interfere with what she must do. Ganga declares that if her husband takes care of these two conditions, then she will live with him happily. As prophesied, a son is soon born to Pratipa. The little prince is named Shantanu. When Shantanu is older, King Pratipa decides to retire to the forest. He gives the throne to Shantanu and tells him about the woman who would marry him and have his children. He also tells him about the conditions she had insisted upon, and he tells Shantanu to follow them closely. A few years passed. One day, King Shantanu was walking along the banks of the river Ganga, where he meets Ganga. Just like in his previous life, Shantanu is completely enchanted with Ganga's presence and beauty. He goes to her and introduces himself. He talks to her. He sings praises of her beauty. And soon, he asks her to marry him. Ganga accepts. But she warns him that she would leave him if he ever interfered with what she must do or if he yelled at her. Shantanu thinks that that's easy enough, and so he agrees. Soon, Ganga and Shantanu are married. They have a few good years. They really like each other. They loved being with each other and enjoy each other's company. And Shantanu was always careful to make sure he wasn't interfering with what she was doing. A task that becomes increasingly difficult to do because when Ganga had a child, she immediately takes that child and throws him into the water, killing him. Shantanu is shocked, but he holds his tongue because he really does not want to alienate Ganga. Ganga does this again and again and again. And she never gives Shantanu any kind of explanation except for consoling him by saying, "I'm doing this for your own good." Shantanu continues to hold his tongue. But things change when Ganga has their 8th child. Shantanu decides that he's had enough. So in a rage, he rushes to Ganga. He yells at her. He insults her, he scolds her, he questions her origins, he asks her what kind of a woman would kill her own children. Throughout his rant, Ganga remains calm, and when he is done, just as calmly, Ganga tells Shantanu that he can have the child. "But," she says, "I cannot live with you any longer. I told you I would leave you if you ever interfered with my actions or if you yell at me. And so the time has now come." Ganga finally explains to Shantanu about why she was doing what she was doing. She tells him the truth about her real identity. She tells him about the Vasus, Vasistha's curse, why she had to marry him and why she had to kill their children. Ganga decides that she would take her infant son with her. She promises Shantanu that when the time was right, she would return him his son and heir. Shantanu is saddened, but there really was nothing he could do about it except wait for Ganga to return him his son and heir. It's a weirdly interesting story, isn't it? I've always wondered if this story signifies something else. Is it just a story or is it trying to tell us something else? And I looked it up and I understand that this is somebody else's interpretation of the story, but it's really interesting, so bear with me. some believe that the story is about miscarriage, stillbirths, and other such cases of infant or fetal mortality, and the story is an attempt to help grieving parents and relatives to make it all make sense and to provide a sense of closure for them. And it makes sense that during a time when they didn't have the medical advances that we have now, these stories helped provide answers. And there are still many questions that the medical community does not have answers for. So stories like these can help people in times of distress. And also, sometimes you just want to be consoled on a more spiritual level rather than through cold, hard logic. And that's part of why these stories exist, right? I wonder what you think about it. I'm interested to know, so leave me a comment what you make of all of these. Years passed since Ganga took her infant son with her. She names him Gangadatta, or given by Ganga. He is also called Devavrata or Gangeya, but more commonly he was called Devavrata. Shantanu was a successful king, and just like his father before him, he ruled justly and wisely. But he was older now and he was ready to share his responsibilities and eventually retire. One day he was out hunting in the forest. He was following the trail of a deer he had shot when he reached the banks of the river Ganga. While there, Shantanu is surprised to find that the river Ganga was shallower than it usually was. Also, it was not flowing the way it usually did. So Shantanu goes looking around, seeing what had changed. He's surprised when he finds a young, well-built, handsome man shooting arrows into the river. The arrows had formed a dam, and that is what was changing the way Ganga was flowing. It was most extraordinary, and Shantanu was curious about this boy, but before he could go and speak to him, the boy had disappeared. Suspicion niggles at the back of Shantanu's mind. What the boy had achieved was truly extraordinary, and not anybody could do that. Shantanu had questions, and so he goes to Ganga and asks her about their son. Ganga's answers confirm Shantanu's suspicions. The young man was indeed his son, Devavrata. Shantanu was ecstatic. Ganga finally presents Shantanu with their son. She tells him that he is now ready to go with his father and assume his rightful place as the heir to the throne. She tells Shantanu that Devavrata was educated under the tutelage of sage Vasistha, and he was trained in Veda and other sacred texts, philosophy, the art of warfare and weapons. He was particularly good at archery, a fact Shantanu had already witnessed. Ganga finally sends Devavrata with Shantanu. The newly reunited father and son return to the capital city of Hastinapura. Shantanu is very pleased when he sees Devavrata had easily adjusted to his new home. Devavrata was very likable and he had a charming personality. So people in the court and people of his new family accepted him very easily. And the news that he would be heir apparent was also easily accepted. About 4 years had passed since Devavrata's return, and Shantanu could not be happier with his wonderful son. At this point, Devavrata was already made an heir officially. Shantanu loved to hunt, just like the many kings belonging to the Kuru lineage. And so one day he was out on a hunting trip, and this time he went to a forest situated along the river Yamuna. He He was walking along the banks of the river Yamuna when a beautiful fragrance permeates the air. He's curious about this fragrance, so he follows it. And this leads him to a beautiful young woman who was working on a fisherman's boat. Shantanu goes to her and he starts talking to her. He learns that her name was Satyavati and she was the daughter of the chief of the local fisherman tribe. Satyavati was beautiful with attractive features and glowing black skin. She was intelligent and charming, and Shantanu was completely taken by her. Shantanu wanted to marry her, and so he goes to her father and asks for her hand in marriage. Satyavati's father was interested in this most advantageous match, but he tells Shantanu that he will agree for the match only if Shantanu promises him that the son born to Satyavati would be made heir. This was an audacious demand. Pretty gutsy, really. But Satyavati's father had his reasons. You see, Satyavati was no ordinary girl. Her biological father was a king by the name Uparichara. Uparichara had two children with a woman named Adrika who belonged to the fisherman community. They had a son who later formed the Matsya dynasty and the daughter Satyavati. As per Uparichara's wishes, the chief of the fisherman tribe adopted and raised Satyavati as his own. He had always believed that Satyavati was destined for greater and better things, and hence the demand. Now, Shantanu was completely in love with Satyavati, but what her father was asking was not possible because Shantanu already had an heir and that was not up for negotiation. Shantanu was broken-hearted. Back in his palace, he continues to nurse his broken heart. The fact that his father seemed sad and withdrawn does not escape Devavrata's notice. He goes to his father and asks him what the matter was, but Shantanu just brushes him off. When Devavrata pressed for answers, Shantanu tells him something vague like, "You know you're my only heir, and if something were to happen to you, the future of this kingdom would be in peril. Thoughts like these keep me up at night," he says. Devavrata knows something is happening with his father and he wants to know what. So he goes to a trusted advisor and friend of his father's. After finding out all the facts, Devavrata takes a few of the advices from the court and heads to meet Satyavati's father. He tells Satyavati's father that he's there to arrange a match between his father and Satyavati. "I'm aware of the conditions you have put forth, and I promise you that the son of Satyavati will be made heir." But Satyavati's father is not convinced. He says, "Well, that's all well and good, but what happens when your children decide that they deserve the throne?" Satyavati's father drives a hard bargain, right? But Devavrata wanted to make sure that his father was happy. And this all goes back to Vasistha's words. Remember how he said Prabhasa would make sure to keep his father happy in his next life. So that's what this is about. So Devavrata wanted to make sure his father would marry Satyavati because he believed that would make his father happy. So he declares that he will never have children. And he took up a vow of brahmacharya from that day onwards. This was really a great sacrifice because not only was Devavrata a prince and an heir who was trained all his life to believe that it was his duty to provide sons and heirs for the continuation of the Kuru line, but also because people in the ancient times viewed procreation and birth of sons in particular as a necessary and spiritual experience. a belief that is held by many even to this day in our culture. So what he was doing was really extraordinary, because he was giving all that up just to make his father happy. It was incredible, and it worked. Satyavati's father finally gives his consent for the marriage, and so Satyavati, along with Devavrata and other members of the court, goes to Hastinapura. Shantanu is finally reunited with the woman he loved, and soon they are married. When Shantanu learns of how his son convinced Satyavati's father and the sacrifices he had made for his sake, Shantanu is grateful for what Devavrata did. He is in awe of his loyalty and selflessness. And not just Shantanu, even the gods in the heavens were in awe of what Devavrata did. And because he took such a terrible vow, the gods name Devavrata Bhishma, which means terrible or fierce. As a show of his appreciation for Devavrata's selfless actions, Shantanu awards him with a boon, which gave Devavrata the ability to choose the time of his death. While Bhishma does not ascend the throne, he is an important part of the Kuru court. He is the supreme commander of the Kaurava forces. After their father's death, Bhishma helped his young brothers to rule the kingdom. He even helped them find brides. When there was a crisis regarding succession, Bhishma, along with Satyavati, made difficult decisions to make sure that the Kuru line continued. When the Pandavas returned to Hastinapura after the death of their father Pandu, Bhishma took on the role as their guardians, made sure that they were well taken care of and they were given the education and training that was due to them as princes. Even when the Pandavas were older, Bhishma tried to do right by them. However, he was criticized by many who felt that he had not done enough to shield the Pandavas from the actions of their cousins Duryodhana. Just as Vasistha had said, Bhishma was a great warrior and he always upheld his dharma. The biggest test of his long life comes during the Kurukshetra war. Bhishma was the commander of the Kaurava forces, sworn to serve King Dhritarashtra, and so he had to fight for the Kauravas. But he was also the grand uncle of the Pandavas. He loved them and believed them to be on the right side of Dharma. He absolutely did not want to fight against the Pandavas and he did not want to harm them. His actions prompted criticism from Duryodhana, who accused Bhishma of showing favoritism and not fighting properly against the Pandavas. He was caught between wanting to do the right thing and being on the side of Dharma, but having to do his job, which was also his Dharma, but which meant he would be on the side of Adharma. Bhishma was undefeatable in battle, and although he did not cause any harm to the Pandavas, he caused plenty of damage to their army, a fact Krishna was not very happy with. Krishna used his cunning to defeat Bhishma, and as preordained, Shikhandi brought about his end. The end saw a severely injured Bhishma lay upon a bed of arrows which had pierced through him. He lay on it for 58 days and chose an auspicious day of the first day of Uttarayana or winter solstice as the day his soul left his body and ascended to the heavens, just as Vasistha had promised the Vasus. The anniversary of Bhishma's death is celebrated as Bhishma Ashtami. Ashtami refers to the 8th day of the fortnight of the month of Magha of the Hindu calendar. It is celebrated by many still. devotees honor Bhishma and also his ancestors on this day. They seek the deity's blessings. Some even pray to be blessed with sons possessing Bhishma's virtues. And that is the story of Bhishma. That is all I have for you today. I hope you like the story. Thank you so much. Dhanyavada.